Okay, thank you. It's an honor to be here addressing you, and I'd like to talk about sustainability in a broad sense. You probably don't know what sustainability science is. This is from a citation analysis of all the work in sustainability. And you can see from this that it covers quite a lot of ground. And I think the real issue here in sustainability is to try to put all of these different pieces together, to try to understand how our ecological life support system and the human system interact with each other, and how we can create a more sustainable and desirable future. Why do we have to do this? Why do we have to do this now? Why is it so critical? I think part of the reason is that we live in a different world. Things have changed quite dramatically just in the last 100 years or so. We used to live in a world that was relatively empty of humans and their artifacts, and that's no longer the case. We now live in what some have called a full world of humans and their artifacts. In fact, Paul Crutzen has called this a new geologic era. We live in the Anthropocene. We no longer live in the Holocene because of the magnitude of the impact of humans on the rest of nature. We also have to recognize that we are a part of this natural world. It's not humans versus the environment or humans as a separate thing, but we are part of this planet and the ecology of the planet, and have been for at least several hundred thousand years. So better understanding how that interaction works and how we can continue to be a part of this system, I think, is the challenge that we're facing in this new situation where we're in a full world. We also have to realize that solving complex problems of any kind requires the integration of these three elements, of having an adequate vision not only of how the system works, our scientific paradigms, our understandings of the system, which is rapidly changing. So we know much more about how complex systems function. We know much more about human psychology. We know much more about the workings of the biophysical system on this planet. We have to take that into account, but we also have to integrate that with how we would like the world to be, our visions for the future. And the whole idea of sustainability is really in that vein. We would certainly like to have the world be sustainable, at least our presence on the planet continue. But we also want that to be a desirable world for ourselves and our children. So I think our challenge is to create a sustainable and desirable future. And what we mean by that, I think, is part of the ongoing discussion. Our tools and analytical techniques and our implementation strategies, our policies, our institutions, all of those things need to be then consistent with this evolving and changing vision. So what I'll talk about today, I think, are all three of these elements, both what we know about how the world works and how that's changing, and also how we can analyze that, and some different kinds of institutions that we might implement to help us achieve our goals. We know, for example, that complex systems behave in nonlinear ways. We know that as you change a control variable in the system, nothing may happen for quite a while, and then you hit a threshold and things change quite dramatically. And there's also often not a direct path back after these changes have been made. There's hysteresis in the system, so you can't go back up the same path that you came down. At a global scale, this can be quite dramatic. We know that there are potential tipping elements in the climate system. This is from a recent paper by Tim Lenton et al. That shows some of those potential tipping elements. The melting of the ice sheets is probably the most well-known one, but there are several others, including the dieback of the Amazon rainforest and changes in Enzo and the changes in the Indian monsoon system. All of these things could change the climate system much more quickly than we had anticipated. So we, myself and a large group of co-authors recently tried to put together an analysis of what is the safe operating space for humans on this planet around these nine different variables, including climate change and ocean acidification and ozone depletion, biogeochemical cycles, nitrogen, phosphorus, freshwater use, land use, biodiversity change, et cetera. So the Earth here is the safe operating space, and you can see that three of those variables are already well outside of that safe operating space. Climate change is probably the best studied of those phenomena, but also the nitrogen cycle and certainly biodiversity loss. So what we mean by this is that there is room, certainly room for humans to survive and prosper within this biophysical limit. But we have to recognize what those limits are and live well within them. Now, of course, this is not a movie that most people want to go to. They tend to want to go to this other movie and to be told that, well, everything's okay, we don't have to worry, technology will save us, we can continue along the same lines that we've been going. Actually, I think there's a third movie that we need to write and produce and create. And that's the movie that tells us how we can have a better life if we learn how to live within these planetary boundaries, if we recognize that some of our policies are simply insane, we cannot have continuing economic growth in the conventional sense, for example, on a finite planet. So how do we create that alternative movie in a way that will actually appeal to people and will be a more positive vision going forward? Of course, there are others who say, well, don't worry about it. This is an actual ad from Diesel Clothes. This is their Global Warming Ready line of clothing. So if you're an adaptionist, you can say, well, it doesn't really matter. This is Manhattan in the background. If you don't recognize it, the Empire State Building, with up to about the 90th floor. So their ad campaign is saying, don't worry about these things. As long as you have, good clothes and nice companions, everything will be fine. However, some in the mainstream media, I think, are also beginning to get the message. This is from a recent op-ed by Thomas Friedman in the New York Times. And he's asking, well, what if this recession that we're still in, started in 2008, we're still in it, what if it's telling us something about this economic model that we've been pursuing for the last 50 years, that it's just not economically or ecologically sustainable? I think it's also important in understanding sustainability that we take a much longer perspective. This is a project I've been involved with called IHOPE, Integrated History and Future People on Earth, that attempts to look back over the whole history of Homo sapiens on the planet and try to integrate what we now know about our environmental history with what we know about human history, and ask the questions about what has actually led to the development, the growth, the collapse of historical societies. So what you see on this graph, if you can see it back there, I'm not sure how well it doesn't seem to be in focus too well, but this is on a log scale going from 100,000 years ago to the present. And humans as a species, Homo sapiens, has been around for maybe 250 or 300,000 years. Most of that was during a period when climate, this is the temperature record in red, was quite erratic, going from ice ages to interglacial periods, et cetera. It wasn't until the beginning of the Holocene, right around 10,000 years ago, that the climate stabilized and has been stable for most of the entirety of the development of human civilization as we know it. It sort of allowed agriculture and sedentary development settlements to occur. Over here is all of the various technological changes that have occurred over that period and the different civilizations that have come and gone. You can see that we're now sort of pushing this out of that sort of narrow window towards a higher temperature regime. What is that going to mean? Just to point out a few other things on this diagram, you can see that these are all the changes in gross world product and human population and CO2 emissions. There are things like the Roman climate optimum during the Roman Empire. The climate in the Mediterranean was particularly well suited to growing wheat, and different than it was before and after that period. So how much influence did climate have on things like the rise and fall of the Roman Empire and the Mayans and et cetera, or things that we're studying as part of this overall initiative? Not to try to predict the future, but to try to better understand the future so that we can create a more sustainable one. We also know that, and I'm going to take a second and just try to change the resolution on this projector, because I think it's a little bit stretched that way and not really high resolution. Hang on. Yeah, that seems to be what it's set on. Okay. And it doesn't seem to want to go any higher. All right.
60 hertz.
Yeah, 60 hertz. Okay. Yeah. Never mind. Where I can see it too. Okay. So we also know that we are approaching the peak of world oil production. Whether that's occurred yet or not, or whether it's a few years down the road is debatable, but I think it's clear that oil and gas liquids are not going to last forever. And in fact, the net energy from those oil and gas liquids is projected to decline even faster, because they get harder and harder to find as we move out into the middle of the Gulf of Mexico and drilling 10,000 feet below that. So we also know that the geographic distribution of the remaining oil stocks is quite problematic. The red circles here are the ultimate recoverable oil and gas liquids, and the black circles are the remaining oil stocks. So you can see that most of the big black circles are over here in the Middle East and the former Soviet Union, in very sort of politically sensitive places. At the same time, we're generating, I think, much better understanding of how this complex life support system that we live in functions. This is from a global climate model produced by NCAR, the National Center for Atmospheric Research. And you see on this one in white relative humidity and in orange precipitation over a one-year run of this climate model. So we're able to synthesize quite a lot of information about how this system works. Not perfect by any means, but certainly much better and able to answer questions like what would happen to the system if we increase CO2 concentration, or if we change land use patterns, if we do other things that might affect the functioning of the climate system. This has all been summarized by the IPCC and more recently used by the Stern Review on the economics of climate change to try to assess the costs and benefits of dealing with this potential problem. So they asked the question, well, first of all, displayed some of the major changes that would occur in the Earth system due to climate change, of various temperature increases on average, on food, on water, on ecosystems, on extreme weather events, on the risk of abrupt and major irreversible changes of the tipping point variety that I was showing earlier. And you can see that there is certainly a lot of uncertainty and a lot of geographic distribution. Things will not change the same all over the planet. but as the temperature rises, the chances of these kinds of problems increases. They estimated that the cost of keeping the planet within 2 degrees temperature rise was on the order of 1% of global GDP. devoted to that effort. But the cost of not doing that, the cost of allowing these changes to occur, would be on the order of 5 to 20% of global GDP. So it's a significantly good investment from society's point of view to deal with climate change now. So one question I want to put to you today is, in this new world that we're in, this new full world context, what do we really mean by the economy, and what is the economy for? The conventional view on this is that the economy is the market, and the purpose of that is to expand production of goods and services, people's standard of living, et cetera, almost indefinitely. But I would argue that in this full world context, living within planetary boundaries, we need to go back maybe to a more basic definition of what the economy is. The economy is to provide sustainable human well-being. And how do we do that in this new context? The conventional view, if you take a macroeconomics course, is quite simple. The economy is firms and households, and they exchange goods and services and factors of production, and money flows in the opposite direction. There's not much notice of inputs from nature. There's not much notice of the impacts of those outputs on the natural sinks. There's not much notice of biogeophysical cycles outside of the human part of the economy. There's not much notice that we actually live on a finite planet that's powered by solar energy. Another way to think of this is the sort of the empty world model of the economy that still drives, I think, a lot of thinking and policy making, that there are these three primary factors of production: land, labor, and capital. But land is kind of grayed out here because there's the assumption of perfect substitutability between these factors. We can do without land and natural resources, the topic of this seminar. All we have to do is substitute more manufactured capital and labor. We can keep goods and services growing, being produced. Those are either then consumed or reinvested to produce more capital so that we can produce and consume more in the next period. So the basic premises of this model are that more is always better. This economy can grow forever. The scale of the economy within the ecological life support system is not really an issue. Poverty can best be solved with more economic growth, that things will trickle down. We just need to make the pie bigger. That nature is a sideshow. It's nice to have a nice environment, but it's not really essential. And that private property is always the best way to manage these resources, because we're talking about essentially private goods and services, things that are rival and excludable. However, I think a different model is really required for this full world context that we're in, one that recognizes that we're living in a materially closed Earth system. Everything has to go somewhere. You can't increase the physical production of the economy indefinitely. In fact, it's been said that the only people who believe you can have exponential growth forever on a finite planet are economists and madmen. So we have to recognize that these four types of capital are all essential, and they are not infinitely substitutable. Conventional manufactured capital, our human capital, or labor, individual people, their information and health and well-being as individuals, but also our social capital, all of the interactions between people, both our formal and informal networks and institutions and governments and all of those kinds of things, which are essential to make this system function, but also are essential to contributing to human well-being even outside of the conventional production system. And finally, our natural capital assets, all of our natural resources and ecosystems and the services that they provide, the benefits that they provide to humans. It also recognizes that human well-being is a much more complex function than simply the more we consume, the better off we are. It recognizes that, as we know from the emerging science of happiness, as it's been called, that human well-being depends on a lot of other things than consumption. In fact, it's more relative consumption than absolute consumption that leads to a sense of well-being. So how do we build an economy? How do we build an economics that really understands this new vision of the world that's emerging, this new understanding of how the world works. So I think we need a more ecological economics. You probably know that ecology and economics both come from the same Greek root, oikos, which means house. So ecology is literally the study of the house. Economics is the management of the house. We have to do those two things in a much more integrated way than we have in the past. You can think of three integrated questions or goals that we need to address within that. One is to maintain this ecologically sustainable scale or magnitude of the economy within the ecological life support system. If we intend to be sustainable, we have to stay within the planetary boundaries that I outlined before. We have to have a socially fair distribution of resources, both within the current generation of humans, but also between the current generation and future generations. That's sort of the Brundtland definition of sustainability. But also between humans and other species that we share the planet with. And we have to have a more economically efficient allocation of resources. The current market system has huge externalities. There are many things that are external to the market that are important to our well-being. So unless we bring those in, we have not an efficient allocation mechanism. We certainly don't have a fair distribution at the present. And it's arguable whether our current scale is sustainable. In fact, there's good evidence that we've surpassed that sustainable scale as the planetary boundaries diagram showed. How do we achieve these goals or answer these questions? Well, we can't do that from the perspective of any one discipline. I think we need a truly transdisciplinary dialogue and discussion on these questions. We need to focus more on the problems and their solutions rather than methodological tools. We need to take a more integrated approach to science, one that puts together synthesis and analysis, and puts at least as much emphasis on synthesis as on analysis. And we need more effective and adaptive institutions to do this. We need to better understand this whole idea of quality of life and well-being. And that has a lot of different dimensions. This is one attempt to sort of put some of the elements together. And I think it includes these three elements of subjective well-being. There's been a lot of work recently on surveys of subjective well-being around the world, asking people, you know, how happy are they? How is their well-being doing? Those things depend on how well this basic set of human needs are actually satisfied. And there's been a lot of work on that as well, but recognizing that human needs are much more than just consumption and subsistence. So they extend to this whole longer list of affection and security and leisure and spirituality, creativity, identity, freedom. All the things you'll recognize, I think, are important to your own quality of life. But we need to do that in a more systematic way. What we can do from a policy perspective is to arrange our assets, our natural, our built, our human, and our social capital in a way that allows people to meet those needs and to feel the sense of subjective well-being in the most appropriate way. So understanding that whole spectrum of relationships, I think, is an important agenda going forward to create, if our goals include creating this sustainable and desirable future. This is just some data on GNP per capita, this sort of consumption-oriented index versus subjective well-being. Or happiness. You can see that there's sort of a threshold saturation curve that occurs in these kinds of data. That certainly there's a period when more economic growth is very contributes a lot to increasing well-being or happiness. But then there's also a period where additional economic growth is not really helping. It's not really contributing all that much to additional well-being. So what we should perhaps be looking for is more, you know, hitting this sweet spot rather than just continuing to grow and assuming that that's going to help the entire system. How do we perhaps reduce consumption in the overdeveloped countries and allow for some increased consumption in the underdeveloped countries? Again, if our goals are not merely continued growth, but sustainable human well-being. How we usually measure economic progress is with GNP or GDP. It's well known that these measures were never designed as measures of economic well-being. They only measure economic income and only the marketed part of that economic income. So it's how fast are the wheels turning, not whether you're going in a good direction. So you can get some very strange things happening if you use those as proxies for well-being. If there's an oil spill, somebody has to go clean it up. That's going to lead to more activity. If there's more crime, if there's more pollution, et cetera, that's going to lead to more economic activity, more GDP. But that's not necessarily a good thing. So there are some alternatives to try to separate the cost from the benefits. Things like the Index of Sustainable Economic Welfare that Herman Daly came up with. Also, it's been renamed the Genuine Progress Indicator. I'll show a little more detail about what difference it makes if you do that. But ultimately, we might want to go towards measuring human needs and how well those needs are being met more directly. And our goal maybe should be to maximize the meeting those needs with the minimum amount of GDP, not equating GDP with well-being. The ISCW, or GPI, Genuine Progress Indicator, looks like this. It starts with personal consumption expenditures, which are a big component of GDP, but then it weights them by income distribution to take into account the saturation curve that I talked about. And if you're talking about a dollar's worth of income to a rich person, doesn't produce as much welfare as a dollar's worth of income to a poor person. So if you're talking about welfare instead of income, you've got to adjust for that. It adds a few things that are left out of GDP, like the value of household labor and volunteer work. And then it subtracts a whole bunch of things here that are part of GDP but really shouldn't be, like the cost of crime and family breakdown and underemployment. And all these things in green are losses of natural capital components, air and water pollution, and loss of wetlands and farmlands, et cetera. So how big a difference does that make? Well, here's some studies that have been done for various countries around the world. You can see that it's for a while, at least, in many countries, since the end of World War II, there was a very good correlation between GDP and ISCW in this case. But in the US and in Europe as a whole, more recently, there's been a divergence in those two curves. We're in a period in the US that has been called a period of uneconomic growth. The economy is growing, but it's not economic because it's not really improving overall well-being. This is what it looks like for the US in a little more detail, showing that since about 1975, GPI has not really improved at all, even though GDP has more than doubled. So we've been in a quality of life or a well-being recession in the US ever since 1975. This, and again, I'm not advocating GPI as the perfect indicator, but certainly it's a better index of economic welfare than GDP. And if our goals are really to improve that, to improve welfare, we haven't been doing a very good job, and we've been missing the boat quite dramatically. And at the same time, causing all of these external costs. This is not the case everywhere. We did a study for the state of Vermont in the US that showed that even though the US GPI per capita was flat or decreasing, in Vermont things were still improving. So it is possible to make a better balance between the natural and social capital, things that are outside the market and the things that are inside the market, and actually improve social well-being. And all of the quality of life surveys, the subjective well-being surveys that have been done in Vermont show that that's also the case. The state of Maryland in the US is, I think, the first government body that has adopted the GPI as one of their official state statistics. So they're beginning to use these kinds of measures as alternatives to GDP. The country of Bhutan, I think, has taken it even a step further. And their king several years ago suggested that their policy goal in Bhutan was gross national happiness, not gross national product. And so they've actually taken this forward. They have a gross national happiness commission, which is their major government planning commission. And they've done some pretty elaborate surveys of subjective well-being across the country. We were there recently to do a workshop on trying to incorporate natural capital and ecosystem services into their national accounting framework. So the bottom line, I think, in all of this is that our growth in material consumption, this GDP, which has been driving a lot of policy decisions around the world for the last 50 years is really no longer sustainable. We're bumping up against the planetary boundaries and have surpassed several of them already, as you well know. But it's also not desirable. It doesn't necessarily bring additional happiness, particularly in the overdeveloped countries. So better understanding what does contribute to well-being and happiness, I think, is a critical part of what we need to do to solve this problem. We know, for example, that social capital is very important. I already mentioned that. This is a map of social capital in the US that was done by Robert Putnam several years ago in a book called Bowling Alone. So he looked at an index of participation in social groups, people's levels of trust of each other, their participation in other kinds of social media, and ranked the different US states along those lines. You can see Vermont that I talked about is up here. You don't know where that is, but that's had a much higher quality of life because of that, or partially at least because of that higher level of social capital. And I don't know if any of you have been to the US, but if you've been to Nevada and Las Vegas, you'll certainly, I think, agree with this assessment of the degree of social capital there. There's also good emerging evidence that the income inequality across countries is highly correlated with this whole range of social problems. This is from a recent book by Wilkinson and Pickett called The Spirit Level. the reason, I think, is because this high levels of income inequality really discourage forming social capital, discourage trust among individuals, and lead to a whole range of other problems and reductions in quality of life. So recognizing, I think, those inputs to our well-being are extremely important. Where's France on here? I really checked it out. Yeah, it's sort of right in the middle, right there. The US is way up here and has been getting worse significantly since about the 1980s. So the other major input that needs to be incorporated is our natural capital and ecosystem services. So ecosystem services are the benefits that people derive from functioning ecosystems. Several years ago, we did a synthesis study, tried to put together all of the information that was out there on those services and their value, and we came up with this list of 17 services, ranging from climate regulation to water supply and soil formation, pollination services, refugia, raw materials, recreation, cultural amenities. Many of these things people don't really perceive as being benefits. They're kind of in the background, but they're certainly necessary for human well-being and certainly for the sustainability of that well-being. More recently, the Millennium Ecosystem Assessment was a 1,300 scientist assessment of the status and trends of ecosystem services and how they connect with the various constituents of human well-being. And they categorize these services into these four major groups of provisioning, regulating, cultural, and supporting services. So, some basic facts about ecosystem services. First, you have to recognize that these are natural capital contributions in combination with the other three forms of capital that I showed on the model diagram. So they're not things that occur independently, but it's really a matter of having the right balance of those four types of capital to produce benefits. They represent, however, a significant contribution to our well-being. They're being threatened and degraded by human activities. Especially climate change and biodiversity loss. And this approach, I think, can help to identify and quantify the trade-offs among that can aid decision-making and on which decision-making should be based. And I think an important point is that many, if not most, of these services are public goods. They're not rival, they're not excludable, so they should not be privately owned or traded in private markets. Therefore, we need to create a different kind of institution to help manage them effectively. There is a huge increase in interest in this idea of ecosystem services. Going forward, just a couple of things that I could mention. There was the recent TEEB study, the economics of biodiversity and and of ecosystems and biodiversity that was funded by the Deutsche Bank and the UN. The US management agencies, including the EPA and the USDA and the USGS, are all taking an interest in ecosystem services. And there's a new emerging ecosystem services partnership that's being formed that tries to put together all of the different groups, of which there are literally thousands, I think, these days, working on this topic, to try to build some coordinated critical mass to sort of move this idea forward. So I'd encourage you all to take a look at that and consider individually or institutionally joining that partnership if you're working on ecosystem services. And there's a conference coming up in October. Even the World Bank, I think, is getting interested in this idea of ecosystem services. This is a quote from the current president saying that they are launching this partnership on ecosystems and their services, and recognizing that, you know, we have to take our natural wealth into account, and we shouldn't be the value of these services shouldn't be assumed to be zero. So how do we assess the value of these ecosystem services? There are many different techniques that are involved in this. There's not one right way to do it, but I thought I'd give you one quick example of how you might assess the value of coastal wetlands, in this case for storm protection. If you don't recognize this, this is Hurricane Katrina approaching the coast of Louisiana several years ago. This is the storm surge that was caused by Hurricane Katrina. It was about 18 to 20 feet in height when it hit New Orleans. Part of the reason that it was so high was because of the loss of coastal wetlands around New Orleans in the Mississippi Deltaic Plain as a result of levying the Mississippi all the way out to the edge of the continental shelf. So all of the sediments that were building up this Deltaic Plain were now being deposited off the edge of the shelf and causing other problems and dead zones in the Gulf of Mexico. Drilling for oil and gas in this Deltaic Plain with canals and spoil banks, sort of dissecting it and changing the hydrology. And the reduction in sediments overall due to dams upstream on the Mississippi. So the net effect in that case was a shift from a historical net gain of land in the Deltaic Plain of about 3 square kilometers per year to a more recent net loss of about 65 square kilometers per year. So what we could do is collect data on historical storm tracks. These are hurricane tracks in the last several decades. put that together with GIS data on the location of coastal wetlands, the swaths of the hurricanes, the infrastructure that was in the path of the hurricanes that we derived from nighttime satellite imagery. We knew the total economic damages caused, and we knew the intensity of each individual storm. So we could. And this is the only equation I'm going to show, but this we could create a little regression model that looked at the relative damages as a function of wind speed and wetland area. And then you can manipulate that and say, well, the avoided cost, the change in damages that was due to a 1 hectare gain or loss in coastal wetlands. That explained about 60% of the variation in damages across the range of hurricanes that we included in our data set. We could then take that relationship and project out both the marginal and the total value per hectare, per square kilometer in this case, of wetlands along the Gulf and Atlantic coast of the US. And you can see that there's quite a variation there, but the large values occur where you have all three of those things occurring together, where you have a lot of infrastructure to protect, you have a lot of wetlands to do the protection, and you had a lot of storms to be protected from. So the bottom line on this is that, you know, there was a large variation per hectare per year, but a very high mean and median value in the thousands of dollars per hectare per year. And if you add it all up, you get about $23 billion per year just in the storm protection services. And remember, there were 16 other ecosystem services that we identified. we tried to put all of the studies that were available at the time together like that back in this paper in 1997. And from that, estimated that the total value of all of those services globally was on the order of $16 to $54 trillion per year, which is much greater than global GDP at the time. Not that we did this in a very precise way, but I think the largest section in the paper was actually the section on limitations and caveats and problems. But going through that list, we argued that solving those problems would only lead to larger values in almost every case. So this is almost certainly a conservative estimate, still larger than global GDP. This is how it broke down by biome, across the different biomes and their relative area and their values per hectare per year. Of course, one of the limitations was the lack of data on some of these biomes. This is gradually being filled in, and our assessment that those values would only increase, I think, has been confirmed by more recent studies. We also know that the conversion of these systems from their intact systems to what the alternatives might be, in this case, wetlands to intensive farming, these days actually leads to a reduction in their total value. The value of all of the services from an intact wetland is much larger than the value of the services from an intensive farming area, for example. We did another study that that looked at the benefit-cost ratio of conserving, preserving our current natural capital assets at the global scale. And we used a scenario where we increased the global reserve network, the terrestrial part of that, to 15% of the terrestrial biosphere and 30% of the marine biosphere. The cost of that we estimated to be about $45 billion a year. But the benefits, the difference between the intact natural capital assets and what they might be converted to, was on the order of $4 to $5 trillion a year. So 100-to-1 benefit cost ratio, quite a good investment these days. So what do we do with all this information? As I said, I don't think that privatizing these services and using conventional markets is the way to answer this problem, because they are largely public goods. But we can get the market to tell a better approximation to the truth, and we can send the right economic signals and incentives to the various actors that would change their behavior in the appropriate way. We can do a better job of full cost accounting, so look at the external benefits and costs of activities. There's a company I'm involved with called TrueCost that actually does this for all of the companies around the world, over several thousand companies, where they look at the impacts of both their internal operations and the operations of their supply chain on damages to human health and ecosystem services, and quantify those and try to do a better full cost accounting. We could do a better job of ecological tax reform, taxing bad things like the depletion of natural capital and not good things like labor and income, and remove all of the perverse subsidies that we have on fossil fuels and other things. On the plus side, we could reward those who produce ecosystem services, as they do in Costa Rica. They have a system of payment for ecosystem services that has been quite successful at reforesting the country. We could charge impact fees for development that were actually tied to the impacts on both social and infrastructure and natural capital, and send the right incentives to developers to find ways to do that in a less impactful way. And there's always uncertainty about what these impacts will be, but the question comes down to who should bear the burden of that uncertainty, who should pay for those risks. And we can shift that burden to the parties that stand to gain by using environmental assurance bonds that would require the posting of a bond until the uncertainty about the impacts was removed. So we suggested doing that for things ranging from the oil exploration in the Gulf of Mexico to nuclear power plants. And finally, we can expand the common sector of the economy. You can think of the economy as having or needing to have at least three sectors: the private sector, the public sector, and the common sector, where we keep track of these common assets like the atmosphere, like ecosystem services, natural capital, and social capital, largely. These kinds of institutions can occur at multiple scales, from local to regional to national, and all the way up to the global scale. So we could think of land trusts and watershed trusts at the local scale, all the way up to an atmospheric trust. So think of the atmosphere as a common property asset. as an asset that we all share, both current and future generations. And one mechanism then for managing that asset is to think of it as a trust, set up a set of trustees. We could then use either a tax or a cap and auction system to charge individuals that damage that asset for that damage. We could also reward individuals or pay a dividend to those that to everyone on Earth on a per capita basis that would help not only address global warming but also would address the poverty issues. And we could use the remainder of those assets to restore the atmosphere through payments for ecosystem services, direct investment in renewable energy, et cetera. Of course, some people think we don't need to really wait for that to happen, or we don't need to do it right now. We can always sort of wait until the future, and then this is a little cartoon that says they finally invented a time machine, we could go back, you know, and put a price on carbon when we really should have done that. And this guy over here is saying, we better hurry, but, you know, no, that's the great thing about this technology, we can just wait. Well, I don't think we can wait. We have to move quickly, I think, towards this new vision of a sustainable and desirable future. And just to summarize, these are the major differences, I think, between our current model of development and the model that I'm proposing, that we need to, first of all, shift our major goal away from simply more is better towards better is better, towards towards quality, towards sustainability, recognizing the different roles that the different types of capital play in that system. We need to move away from the basic measures of GDP towards something like GPI. We need to recognize that scale is a real issue that needs to be addressed. We need to stay within the planetary boundaries. We need to worry directly about distribution issues and poverty because we know that that affects our quality of life more directly. We need to deal with economic efficiency and allocation by internalizing many of the things that are currently external. We need to worry about property rights, but in a different way, and establish common property regimes in the right for those goods and services like natural and social capital that really are common, are public goods. We need to have a more a bigger role, but perhaps a different role for government as a facilitator and mediator of some of these processes. And we need to have different, more sustainable principles of governments. This is maybe another way of saying the same thing, but we need to convert our built capital to use renewable resources. We need to fully utilize our human capital. We need to rebuild our social capital and trust in, among individuals. And we need to restore our natural capital asset base and better understand how these four types of capital actually contribute to well-being. There have been a couple of interesting studies along these lines recently, one by Peter Victor in Canada and Tim Jackson in the UK on can we actually have an economy that's not growing, that that does provide for sustainable human well-being. Peter Victor did a computer model of the Canadian economy and showed that, yes, we could have a no-growth disaster, but we could also have a no or low-growth scenario that was much more positive. And in order to do that, we would have to change all of these policies, many of the things that I've already talked about, including reducing inequality, stabilizing population, allowing for more leisure time for people to connect with and have more access to social capital, limiting materials, et cetera, et cetera. Denmark certainly has gone off in that direction, is trying to create an economy that is free of fossil fuels in the next couple of decades. The city of Portland, where I'm now located, has also made tremendous progress in reducing greenhouse gases, probably one of the few places in the US, if not the world, that's on the right trajectory to reduce their greenhouse gas emissions going into the future. And it certainly has not adversely affected their quality of life. In fact, it's improved things quite dramatically. Now, of course, there are always skeptics, but And I don't know if you can read this one, but you know, if we do all of these positive things, this guy in the back is saying, yes, but what if it's all a big hoax and we create this better world for nothing? Well, I think that's maybe part of the problem with the way we're approaching the whole climate change agenda, and that we should be focusing much more on not just what the problems are. Certainly those problems are there, but what are the solutions and what does a better world look like? And present that to the public, because that's, I think, what's necessary to motivate long-term change. We can only do so much with fear of disaster, and that I think only works in the short term. But to motivate long-term change, we have to create a better vision of the future. And there are several groups trying to do that, including the Great Transition Initiative. I know I'm going over time, so I'm going to go a little bit faster here. There's a whole range of people that have been doing scenario analysis, looking at a range of possible futures. So let's create some plausible futures rather than predictions of what we think might happen, and use that as a way to discuss what the choices are today. So the Great Transition Initiative has done that in several cases, and there's lots of other examples of scenario analysis being quite an effective tool for discussing plausible futures with the public. Okay, so I'll end with, I think, this plug for a new journal that we've started called Solutions that's trying to create a venue for this broader discussion among a whole range of scientific disciplines and the policy community on what a sustainable and desirable future would look like and how we might get there. So I'd encourage you all to take a look at this. It's available for free online. website looks something like that. And I'd encourage you to also think about contributing, subscribing, becoming involved in looking for what the solutions are. And my last slide, that this, you know, finding these solutions and creating a system where we can flourish on this biophysically limited planet requires that we break our addiction to this growth at all cost model and paradigm and to overconsumption. To do that, we need to envision a more sustainable and desirable future, and that this is going to require, this is a huge challenge. It's going to require changing almost everything. And it's going to require, I think, almost all of us to contribute in a more collaborative and cooperative way to that exercise. But it's certainly not a sacrifice to do that. It's really a sacrifice not to. So thanks very much.
Thank you, Professor Costanza. We'll take a few questions, very few questions, in fact. We're running out of time.
I might squeeze one. Bob, you showed that we have here.
There you are.
We showed that there is plenty of data. Now I have a specific question. Once we have these data and we work on these data by making synthetic evaluations, cross-checking, and so on, and we put that data out into the public and towards the political world, how much do people agree on that? Are we far from having data on which most of the people could agree on?
Well, I think data needs to be interpreted, you know, and interpretations can be manipulated, and I think uncertainty in the data can be manipulated for various purposes. So I think it's important to recognize we're never going to have the answer that will be definitive, or at least that's that would be rare. So the more important question is how we deal with the uncertainty and who bears the burden, of proof. And in the past, you could argue in an empty world context, you know, the chances that you would be doing something adverse to others were maybe less because there was more slack in the system, there's more. But going forward, I think that's not the case. In the full world context, we've got to assume, you know, that there will be impacts. And the question is, you know, these ideas of assurance bonds are ways to shift the burden to the parties that stand to gain from the activity and away from the public. And I think that's a more important shift, perhaps, than assuming that we'll ever get, you know, the answer, that just more data will, or better data will help solve the problem. Not that it's not important, but I think there's that assumption that we just need better data and reduced uncertainty is, I don't think, going to solve our problems.